planet Earth. You're looking at planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is planet Earth. Earth. Earth.
And we're going to now have a song to head us off, to say, tell us what the Earth is about. This is Earth's Song, A Beautiful, Beautiful World, and it's by Storybots. The lyrics are by Eric Weiner, and the music is by Mark Weiner.
We are currently orbiting planet Earth.
I'm picking up some noises. Sounds like cool music.
Such a beautiful, such a beautiful, beautiful world.
I'm the Earth, and for what it's worth, 25,000 miles is my girth. I've got more than 7 billion people living on me all across my amazing geography. Check out my mountains, valleys, trees so tall, and I got lakes, rivers, and waterfalls, volcanoes, craters, swamps with alligators, tropical islands at my equator. The North and South Poles have lots of ice, only polar bears say,
this weather's nice.
I've got so much land, yeah, I'm so immense. I got seven different continents. North and South America, Europe, Asia, Africa, Antarctica, and Australia. But the biggest thing everybody can see is that I got a lot of water all over me. I have oceans with lobsters, whales, otters. 3/4 of me is covered in water. I orbit the sun.
I'm so hot.
That's his line. And the moon orbits
it's
me.
It's my time to shine.
I'm filled with life, both big and small. The most beautiful planet of all.
Such a beautiful, such a beautiful, such a beautiful, beautiful world.
It is the home to every boy and girl.
It's a beautiful, beautiful world. I'm getting homesick.
Me too. Computer, take us home.
Topography is the science of measuring the shape of things. Topographers measuring the shape of the Earth have been using satellites of increasing precision since 1958. The Earth is not perfectly spherical. Land masses are of various altitudes. Sea level varies from place to place. Ice thickness changes. Earthquakes alter the shape of the Earth. And the spin of our planet makes the equator bulge more than the poles. This evening, the Space Show presents an update of the fleet of satellites being used by topographers. In January of 2016, Jason 3 was launched to continue the 27-year reference series of measurements of sea level, ocean winds, and waves. Built to last 3 years, Jason 3 is now into an extended mission. Meanwhile, its elder sibling, Jason 2, was still operating until October last year, albeit with attitude control problems. Now it was launched in mid-2008. India and France are conducting operational oceanography and improving the marine geoid with a satellite called SARAL Altikar. This is due to complete its mission this year, but a scientific panel has recommended that its operation be continued. In the next year or two, a new mission called SWOT, S-W-O-T, is planned to provide higher resolution sea level measurements than provided by the Jason satellites. Now, SWOT is an acronym for Surface Water Ocean Topography. Oceans, lakes, and rivers will be measured. In 2016 and 2018, the European Space Agency launched the Sentinel 3A and 3B satellites for the European Union. They work in tandem with precision altimeters. Two more Sentinel satellites, 6A and 6B, are planned to use multiple frequency radars of a new and more accurate design. In October of 2018, China launched a joint French and Chinese satellite called CFOSA. It is a wind and wave scatterometer mission. The European Space Agency was considering a concept called SCIM, the Sea Surface Kinetics Monitoring Mission. If approved, it would utilize a novel wide-swath scanning multi-beam radar altimeter to measure ocean surface currents. Launch would have been in 2025. But last year, the agency chose to proceed with another mission instead. Also under consideration by the European Space Agency for the European Union is CRISTEL. The name is an acronym for Copernicus Polar Ice and Snow Topography Altimeter. It is one of six high-priority candidate missions in competition to be chosen for development. CRISTEL would carry a multi-frequency radar altimeter and microwave radiometer. The aim would be to measure and monitor sea ice thickness and overlying snow depth. Because of rapid climatic changes at the poles, scientists have recommended a long-term commitment to full Arctic coverage altimetry by satellite. Now, CRISTEL would achieve that objective. Satellite measurements at sea level going as far back as 1993 agree with ground-based tide gauge measurements to within 1 centimetre. This excellent agreement provides independent verification that the roughly 3 millimetre per year rise in global sea levels measured by the satellite missions during the last quarter century is real and accurate. Measurements of sea level can be used to infer ocean currents. This is because water runs downhill and the sea level measurements reveal the tilt of the ocean.
2, 1. Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Yes, we're concentrating on the Earth on this evening's The Space Show. You may have seen an article in the Age newspaper today. Not many people read papers these days, but some of you may have seen it. Bureau Weathers Loss of Flight Data is the headline, and it's a story by Liam Mannix. The Bureau of Meteorology has rejected claims by British scientists that its weather forecasts have become significantly less accurate during the coronavirus pandemic. Most weather forecasters rely on real-time temperature, pressure, and wind speed data from commercial jets, which is then fed into mathematical models enabling them to predict the weather days ahead. The system produces about 800,000 observations a day, and studies show it increases some aspects of forecast accuracy by about 20%. But the pandemic has grounded flights across the world. Todd Lane, a professor of atmospheric sciences and meteorology at the University of Melbourne, said that the findings were plausible. But the data period they are looking at is too short to make really robust conclusions. Professor Lane said that satellites are playing a bigger role, meaning aircraft data no longer played such a key role in forecasting. Craig Bishop, a professor of weather prediction at the University of Melbourne, said Australia had fewer flights than Europe, so flight data played a smaller role. Well, Peter May is the head of research at the Bureau of Meteorology, speaking at the Space Science Conference at RMIT University. He gave a talk called Earth Observations from Space.
What I'll be talking about is the importance of Earth observations from space and how that transforms into Bureau services for the national benefit. And as the matter of these kind of review talks, almost effectively none of this work is mine. It's all associated with quite a large team working on these things. So to set the scene, the Bureau has a legislative responsibility to support people, industry, government. That's everything from the day-to-day, do I take an umbrella, like last night, through to disaster preparation, management, tropical cyclones, bushfires and so forth. I think it's undisputable that our services that are constantly improving. I mean, when was the last time you saw a really bad weather forecast? Both the quality of our forecast, the length of time, and the domains that we produce guidance for is increasing. And that's largely through significant national and international investment in our models, and as well as in direct applications of the science. And so I want to start sort of with this around the numerical modelling and talk a little bit about some historical background. It's not actually a new idea. Louis Fry Richardson, in the early part of the 20th century, hit upon the idea of solving the equations of motion and so forth by hand, and came up with the first numerical formulation what we would call a numerical model during the First World War. He got observations from around Europe and started integrating by hand in the trenches of the Western Front in the First World War. He was a stretcher bearer. He was a conscientious objector, refused to fight, but was there sort of saving lives and in his spare time doing these numerical calculations. Unfortunately, he didn't know about numerical instability because the science really hadn't started yet and so forth, and he grew a bit despondent because he dropped the central pressure of Europe by about 50 millibars in the first 6 hours of integration, which took him a couple of years to actually find out. But that report was ultimately published in the early 1920s, and in that he hypothesised a dream of a massive room of 60,000 people with their mechanical calculators being orchestrated. And there's this wonderful illustration from the Irish, I saw it in the Irish Times, of his weather machine with 60,000 people typing away, being orchestrated. So some of the conductors there are people like Charles Babbage and so forth. And as it turns out, 60,000 people wouldn't have been enough. He would have needed more like a million people. This actual concept became practical with the invention of electronic computers. So after the work on nuclear weapons, the next project of the use of ENIAC was around weather prediction. And so there was a massive effort in the US which started in the 1940s, 1950s, around numerical weather prediction. And over the last 50, 60 years, we've reached a stage now which is to my mind, a true triumph of our science, that we take in literally millions of data points and we produce guidance on from hours to days to weeks to months, and including if you look at climate change, it's the same models that we use for climate. So what goes into these models? At one level, it's conceptually trivial. You define the current conditions using a whole suite of observations, be it from space, to measure the temperature, the pressure, the winds and so forth. And the model was just the physical equations. It's Newton's laws, F equals ma, plus the laws of thermodynamics, and then because you've got radiative transfer and the propagation of heating and so forth, a bit of quantum mechanics sneaks in there, and if you start looking at the remote sensing, then you've got GPS and you've got relativistic effects. So we actually cover a fair gamut of modern physics in these models. Conceptually trivial, but of course we're on a rotating sphere with phase changes of materials, a rough surface, processes that are happening on very small scales and turbulence, so it's actually a really ugly problem. When I joined the Bureau, which is a long time ago, more than 25 years ago, it was possible to have a world-class model with a team of half a dozen people. That's no longer the case. These models are incredibly complex. The Bureau's operational model access is a community effort between ourselves, CSIRO, the universities. We have major partnership with the UK Met Office, and my team around numerical modelling is about 60 people. That's not enough to be world-class anymore. We have to partner with the Met Office, who has about three times that number, Korea, who has a similar number to ourselves, New Zealand, part of this partnership, and India, to have a world-class model. It is big science, and it's complex science. But at the simplest level, we have the initial state. We usually integrate with the equations of motion. So given this state, what will the atmosphere and ocean and land surface and cryosphere look like in 5 seconds? Then 5 seconds later and 5 seconds later, and in the case of climate change simulations, out to hundreds of years, and produce our future forecasts. Just to give you an idea, we run global models. So we have to break, to solve these equations, we break the Earth's atmosphere and oceans into blocks. For our global models, for our seasonal forecast system, the size of that block is around 50 kilometres with our new version that's about to go online next year. When we go to our weather prediction for the next 7 to 10 days, we use our global models at around 20 kilometre resolution. As we zoom down to shorter time frames, we can have smaller model domains with higher resolution. So we have a domain that covers most of our region at 12 kilometres, and then our city-based models, which are around kilometre-type scales. And at kilometre-type scales, you can include more and more of the physical processes explicitly. So you've got thunderstorms sitting inside your model at 1 kilometre resolution. You're doing that explicitly. You ask, why don't we do the entire planet at 1.5 kilometres? The answer is, every time you double your resolution, it takes 10 times the computer power. No, because you've got 4 times the grid points, and your time step has to be half as long, because things transport only have to be transported half the distance. So every time you go from 20 kilometres to 10 kilometres, that's 10 times the computer power. You give me a bigger computer, I'll fill it up. No problem. The data that goes into that is satellites, it's surface measurements, it's observations from ships, it's moorings, it's radars, it's observations from space, it's instrumented aircraft. Commercial aircraft are taking observations for us the whole time. In big computing, with petaflop type machines, big data sets, enormous data sets, both as the input and the output from these models. The current suite, with our current operational models, we take in data from around about 30-ish remotely sensed satellite data streams as well. So we measure scatterometers for the surface winds. We get estimate wind motion from, it's one of John's favourite things to do, is he estimates the field of winds and from the movement of clouds and water vapour in the imagery. We've got radio occultation, as well as a whole range of other platforms with microwave sounding units, infrared interferometers with thousands of channels. The list goes on. And that's just for the atmospheric part. Then you've got the ocean. You have to initialise the ocean, which is using altimeter data, scatterometer data, radiometers for sea surface temperature and the like. And similarly for the land surface, we have these models aren't just an atmospheric model. They're quite a complex land surface model. You've got ocean models and so forth that sit with them. So there's an awful lot of data goes into these models. As I said, literally many, many millions of observations into any single forecast. To define the initial state, the computing cost associated with getting that initial state together is about the same as running the rest of the forecast cycle. It's expensive and it's complicated. No talk at the moment from the Bureau would be complete without talking about the Himawari satellite, which the JMA launched a year and a half ago now. It's effectively a MODIS type satellite in geostationary orbit. So we've gone from the previous satellite, MTSAT, where we had 5 channels to 16 channels. It has true colour channels in the infrared and so forth, and also channels that allow us to estimate ozone and carbon dioxide. Crucial both for the directly into the models, but also for direct applications. The other thing about Himawari is we've gone from hourly imagery to 10-minute imagery, and it's at double the resolution, so spatial resolution. So it's just a huge amount of data. We're talking about using a few billion observations into the weather models, but the overall number of observations per year is in the hundreds of billions of pixels. Meteorology is an international game. To do a 5-day forecast, you need data from around the globe, and the weather centres share their science, share their data, and so forth. Going from hourly data to the 10-minute data, that has a bit of an impact. Really starts filling in, and that's important when you start looking at things like tropical cyclones and so forth. I figure it's compulsory to have a GP, a radio occultation slide. And so here, we're taking there's low Earth orbiting satellites. This is there's a constellation of these satellites. There's actually a control centre is now located in Darwin. So it's coordinated with the Taiwanese, the US, and we contribute with the ground station, you know, including the control of the constellation. And what this measuring is the bending angle of the radio waves as the rays propagate through the ionosphere and then through into the stratosphere. And the information that gives you is an unbiased estimate of temperature in the upper part of the troposphere, the part of the atmosphere that we live in, and into the stratosphere.
That's Peter May, the head of research at the Bureau of Meteorology, and we have more from Peter after these messages.
From Sandringham to South Yarra, you're listening to Southern FM.
2, 1. Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling.
Peter May, Head of Research at the Bureau of Meteorology, speaking at the Australian Space Science Conference at RMIT University about Earth observations from space. Yes, our topic is Earth on tonight's The Space Show.
So how important are these observations from space? So this is some of the work which we do is with our system that we put into the models. You can actually look at the impact of individual observations have on the analysis. And so what we've done here is rank them according to which data source has the most impact and the impact per observation. So what you can see is an infrared interferometer called IARSI, a microwave radiometer called AMSU, and the atmospheric motion vectors, the three largest impact data sources that on our models before you get to weather balloons, the synoptic observations, and so on down the list. Basically, our models rely on that satellite data. It's the impact per observation, so you see things like ocean buoys actually have very large impact, and that's because they're in very data-sparse areas, so they have a small number of observations that have an inordinate amount of impact. But overall, the one satellites, and they dominate the skill. So how important is that? So there's a few things to notice. One is the relentless improvement, and so that the day 7 forecast now is comparable to what was back in the 1980s. If you go back to the 1980s and the 1990s, the Northern Hemisphere skill was significantly better than the Southern Hemisphere because they had more observations. You've got all the weather balloons and so forth over the land masses, whereas in the Southern Hemisphere, you've got a lot of ocean and not many observations. That gap pretty much disappeared around the year 2000, and that was due to two things. One is the ever-increasing amount of Earth observation from space data. It's been going up exponentially with time, and our ability to make use of that data has gone up, and there's been some technology jumps in our ability to use that. And so now the model performance that we get in the Southern Hemisphere is every bit as good as the Northern Hemisphere, even though we've got far fewer ground-based observations. But again, you can see continuous improvement due to better models, higher resolution, bigger computers, but also much more satellite data going into them. And on longer time scales, that factors through as well. And so the Bureau next year will be going operational with our new seasonal and multi-week prediction model. It's a 50-kilometre resolution with a 25-kilometre resolution ocean. There's technical reasons why you want it a bit better in the ocean. This is producing multi-week. It's an ensemble system, so we run the model multiple times to look at the range of possible future scenarios. And this has applications for fisheries, environmental monitoring, the bleaching risk on the Great Barrier Reef, the oil and gas industry in terms of tropical cyclone risks and so forth. And, of course, it's got applications for the Navy. The Navy's been a big investor in our ocean modelling capability, although the funding for the seasonal prediction system has been largely through the agricultural community. So that was sort of a quick snapshot of the direct applications of the numerical models. We also have direct applications of the remote sensing for research. We participate in research missions such as the global precipitation measurement. For climate monitoring, the GPS actually is and the global climate observing system has very strong dependencies on the Earth observations from space, but also for things like fog, volcanic ash, bushfires detection, storm tracking. And so I'm just going to flick through a couple of some sample of these applications. So with with storm tracking, as well as using radar and so forth, we're using the satellite imagery to detect the locations. We're using the texture and the growth of the clouds. We're tracking cloud features to look at provide guidance and warnings in remote areas not covered by radar. And so this is just showing an example where tagged locations, looking at the growth and decay of the clouds, how quickly these storms are moving and so forth, and combining that with models, with lightning and so forth. We do the same, similar approaches with volcanic ash. You're using the imagery from the Himawari satellite, looking at the difference between certain infrared channels to detect the presence of volcanic ash, both the tracking of the plumes, but also the making estimates of the mass and the height and so forth, which are important for groups such as the aviation industry. We collaborate nationally and internationally with IMOS, Integrated Marine Observing System, and one of the INCRIS facilities. We work with them on sea surface temperatures and plots of sea surface temperatures. Some of that goes into our models. Some of it's used for direct application. Again, the alarming bleaching events of the past year on the Great Barrier Reef and elsewhere, stark reminders of the importance of these kind of observations. And just to sort of finish this off a little bit, some applications that maybe you wouldn't associate with the Bureau. We're partners in a program called eReefs. If you go to the Bureau website, you can see a marine water quality dashboard for the Great Barrier Reef that includes things like the nutrients, the sediment loads, as well as the temperature. This is in partnership with Queensland Government, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Foundation and so forth. It's using algorithms developed in partnership with CSIRO using MODIS. VIRS is ready to roll if MODIS falls over, providing guidance. And just to show an example of some impact of this, this is showing the chlorophyll A location. So it's really the amount of nutrients that are available. And high amounts of nutrients aren't necessarily a good thing because increases the risk of crown of thorns infestations and so forth. This is immediately before Tropical Cyclone Ida, and you look at what Ida has done is it's actually churned up and actually increased the amount of nutrients available for the life on the reef. Talked about the models and the applications, but the Bureau is involved right through, again, in national and international partnerships. The top left panel is a photo of the ground station controlling the cosmic satellite. We run a network of ground stations in collaboration with Geoscience Australia and others that covers a fair chunk of the globe. It's part of what we contribute. But we've also got the high-performance computing. It's of our new petascale operational machine, Australis. And we've got the people and the tools to visualise the work. We've got the models, the Access model with its 2.5 million lines of code, but the corresponding ocean models, hydrological models, wave models, tsunami models that go in to providing these services to the country. And this is big science. It's not possible for a group like the Bureau to do it just on its own. We partner with Geoscience Australia, CSIRO, the universities. RMIT is a good example. But also with the Met Office, NOAA, JMA, and the list just goes on. So I'd just like to sort of finish up the few key messages about the Bureau responsibilities for the day-to-day forecasting through to disaster management, the impact that our services have on informing decisions. It's dependent on big data, big computing, and it's big science these days. The days of one or two people being able to make big contributions is pretty much over. We're talking big teams and international teams to be world-class. The Earth observations from space is absolutely critical to what we do, both through the models and the direct applications. And the partnerships are key with impacts on the weather, the sea state, bushfires, drought, climate, research. The list just goes on. Thank you.
Addressing the Australian Space Science Conference at RMIT University, that was Peter May, the head of research with the Bureau of Meteorology. The Soil Moisture Observation Satellite is often known by its acronym SMOS, S-M-O-S. The results are described in this European Space Agency feature.
On November the 2nd, 2009, SMOS was launched from the Plesetsk Cosmodrome on top of a rocket launcher. SMOS is one of ESA's Earth Explorer missions that address key scientific challenges and demonstrate new technology in space. Carrying a novel instrument to return information on soil moisture and ocean salinity, both key components of the Earth's water cycle, SMOS is advancing our knowledge of how water is cycled between the Earth's surface and the atmosphere. Understanding these exchange processes is crucial for understanding climate change, for improving weather prediction, and, for example, helping to optimize water consumption when growing crops.
SMOS measures directly the surface soil moisture. So this is really the kind of rain gauge of the atmosphere. So we collect the rain and we store it. Measuring surface soil moisture gives us a hint on the rainfall, so we can partition the rainfall. But also looking at its evolution, we can link it to different other things. One of them is, of course, dryness or wetness of the soil, so floods or droughts. But also the fact that the impact of other events, such as El Niño or La Niña, and its impact on the rainfall distribution, hence the wetness. So it is used to infer or droughts or monitor the droughts, but also, of course, for food security in many regions, to anticipate crop yield, especially in areas which are limited by rainfall.
This research satellite was originally planned to be in orbit for 5 years. But thanks to Europe's technological excellence, it has already doubled its life in orbit, providing time series data for a variety of applications. For instance, SMOS data is used for ESA's climate change initiative, through which data are compiled to understand how climate variables are changing over time. Its data are also combined with data from other satellites, such as Cryosat, to map the thickness of sea ice, a crucial climate variable.
With SMOS, we have the possibility to measure the sea ice thickness. In particular, the thickness of thin ice we can measure with SMOS. We have also the companion, the ESA Earth Explorer Cryosat. This was specifically designed to measure the sea ice thickness, and Cryosat is great to measure the thickness of thick ice from the freeboard. But with SMOS, we can accurately measure the thin ice.
SMOS data are also used to map the freezing and thawing of soil. This is important because frozen soil, and in particular permafrost, acts as a carbon source. When permafrost thaws, carbon is released back into the atmosphere, amplifying the greenhouse effect. By comparing data over several years, SMOS helps us to better understand variables affected by and affecting climate change. Over the years, SMOS has proven to be a versatile satellite, going way beyond its original scientific goals. Today, SMOS data are even used operationally for weather prediction by organisations such as the European Centre for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts.
SMOS is very important for weather prediction because weather is related to forecast of the atmospheric variables, but it's also related to land surface forecast and ocean forecast, river forecast. And for this, for weather prediction, our strategy is to develop an Earth system approach where we have a consistent forecast for the different components of the Earth system. And in this context, variables which are at the interface between land surface and atmosphere, or ocean and atmosphere, are very important to ensure the consistency across the different Earth system components. And SMOS is exactly that. It is providing information at the interface between the different Earth system components.
Over the course of a decade, SMOS has given the scientific community an unprecedented wealth of data. And while it has long surpassed its intended lifespan, SMOS remains hard at work while new missions are being studied and prepared to ensure continuous data sets with even higher resolutions and improved technology.
Our thanks to the European Space Agency for that report. Well, please join us next week when we have episode 2 of our series, our three-part series on the Earth.